Fortnight in Film is a podcast where every week you get the chance to listen in on a group of film lovers chatting about the great, or not so great, movies that we've been watching over the past fortnight. Hello and welcome to episode 8 of A Fortnight in Film. I'm your host Jason.
And I'm your co-host George.
Thanks for tuning in. Got a bit of a rare episode today, but we both agree on the films we're talking about. We both love the films.
I was shocked. I was shocked when this revelation came.
Heads up, the films we're about to discuss may contain spoilers. For a list of the movies we cover this week, check out the description. So let's kick it off with, I guess, my pick. So I've owned this film for so many years, and I just never got around to watching it. Not for any particular reason, I just never did. I'm a procrastinator. I just, you know, put off watching it for ages. And that film is Goodfellas, 1990. Another Martin Scorsese classic, starring the usual characters for the employees, Robert De Niro, Joe Pesci, Ray Liotta. I really liked the movie. I gave it 4 stars. I did have a few problems with it.
Because I see you're not giving that full 5 stars.
I didn't like it as much. I liked it. Like, don't get me wrong. Obviously, if you give something 4 stars, of course I like it. But I didn't like it as much as I thought I would. And I didn't like it, I think, as much as everyone else does. Because a lot of people hold it up there as like an all-time great. I'm like, it was a great film. Is it an all-time great? Debatable.
Okay. So what aspects were kind of missing for you to...
Well, maybe I'll begin with positivity.
Okay, good, yeah.
Obviously, the story was interesting, and it's a true story, as so many of what Martin Scorsese does. He takes, true people. I mean, apart from Taxi Driver, obviously, but, a lot of his other films, Goodfellas, Casino, Raging Bull, The Departed, I could go on and on. The Irishman, he takes a lot of true stories and adapts them to the screen. I thought the performances were good. De Niro was good. Pesci was good. Ray Liotta was good. I do still stand by what I said. I think it was in our October Roundtable episode where I said that when De Niro and Pesci are together in gangster films, I can't take De Niro seriously as a gangster, because Joe Pesci just, like, it's almost like they grabbed a guy out of a mafia and just, like, put him in front of a camera and was like, act.
Tommy DeVito is one of my favorite characters in any gangster film ever. Like, Joe Pesci is just insane. And actually, the real life Tommy DeVito was actually more insane than shown in the film. And you're thinking, like, how? But yeah, he just totally transforms into that character. But I think on your point about Robert De Niro, I don't know, I can take him seriously, because to me he's a different type of gangster. Like, he's not as crazy as, like, he, you can tell that he's quite threatening from just the way he does things. He's silently knocks people off, they're different types of gangsters for me.
Yeah, fair point. Yeah. But yeah, so that, I thought all that was good. I thought the music was good. Not so much the score. I mean, I guess the score was good. I didn't really notice it.
Well, they used a lot of popular songs, didn't they?
So it's like the songs they included were like enjoyable. Yes, it was really just a good, overall really good film. What I didn't like, so one was The Godfather Part 2 does this as well. And this was not the only reason, but one of the reasons why I couldn't give out 5 stars, I gave it 4.5, was I felt like the movie jumped around in terms of like time, and so it would jump from like one place to the next, but there was no like explanation of how we got there, and we seemed to jump. There were a few parts I felt where we seemed to jump quite a bit forward, and there was sort of no context of like how we got from point A to point B.
I think that was just Scorsese. Obviously, you can't cram too much into the film, like you can't cover the whole life of Henry Hill because it's such a big thing. So there comes a point where you have to separate the film into the 3 kind of ages, like when he's a teenager, then it goes to when he's like a young adult, then after he goes to prison. So I don't know, I think that worked, like separating it into those 3 parts. So it would get stuffed otherwise with sort of filler.
Yeah, because it's like when you are trying to tell one person's life story, whether it's a fictional person or a real person, Yes, you obviously, you can't, you know, in however long the film is, 2.5 hours or whatever, you can't, you know, tell the whole life story in that. But I don't know, I just felt there were some jumps where, like, we lacked context, and I was like, how did we get here? And just on that note, too, about the ages, I don't know, I mean, I know why, because obviously, like you said, followed these different periods, but, like, when it jumped to the second part, when, like, they were sort of young adults, I think it was Karen, who obviously ends up being Henry's wife, mentions at some point that, like, you know, they're 21.
She mentions he's 21, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm like, you're not passing for 21, dude. Like, you look like you're 40. Like,
I don't know. Wait, what age was he when he
shot? Yeah, I'd be interested to find out, because I imagine a lot of them were like late 30s, early 40s, like all three actors.
Ray Liotta was like 37, I think, 36, 37. So okay, I get it. Yeah, I don't, the thing is, I don't know. I didn't think of that, because I'm so normally, whenever I watch it, I'm just so wrapped up in the story, that didn't really occur to me. But yeah, I guess that's a funny thing that you can nitpick. Like, it's not really...
I'm not holding that against the films. That was just a funny thing. It's like, you know, some TV shows you watch and they're set in high school and they have like 30-year-olds playing 16-year-olds. I'm like, you aren't in high school. Like, come on. Yeah, like...
yeah, like Riverdale... all those Netflix like ones. Yeah, I know. I get it. Yeah, that's true.
But I will say they cast the young when he was like a teenager in the first bit. That resemblance.
Yeah, he was great.
I was looking at him, I'm like, is that like his son? Like, because it was the resemblance, they cast that very well, and that's hard to do.
Also, I love the opening line. What did he say? He's like, I've always wanted to be a gangster. Yeah.
Yeah, that was it. It had a lot of quotable lines.
Oh, it's probably my favourite scene in the whole film, I think, is Joe Pesci and Ray Liotta in the club. When Joe Pesci's like, am I a funny guy? Am I a funny guy? You know, and then, that scene is very iconic.
Oh, yeah. And I'd actually seen that scene prior. I'd seen that scene so many times before I'd seen the movie. But even though I'd seen it and I knew it was going to happen, you still feel like, on edge, you know, you're still like, is he going to take it away? Like,
yeah, because like you just don't know if he's serious or if he's like putting his leg, and it kind of goes like back and forth, and then he whacks the guy on the head with a bottle, and you're like, okay, this guy is very unhinged, very.
And of course, the other iconic line where Billy Bats tells Joe Pesci's character, yeah, tells him, you know, go home and get your fucking shine box. Not a very smart thing to say to him, because he obviously ended up dying for it.
That scene, that argument, they kind of end it in quite a civil way. Like, they both apologize, and then Bats must say the final word, and then it just goes, and then it goes off from there. He just has to say it, doesn't he?
You see that in a lot of mafia films, and it's interesting because I feel like that doesn't happen in real life. You know, like, I feel like in real life you can have people who know each other and they can sort of, you know, take the mickey out of each other a bit and sort of needle each other. And, you know, there's not really going to be any hurt feelings. But it's like in the mafia, like if you sort of say the wrong thing to the wrong person, you're done, you know.
But that's a good point. That's what I was gonna mention that. Like, the film, it doesn't, like, Scorsese isn't glorifying the mafia at all. Like, instead, I think he's showing how, like, cutthroat and how crazy that it can be. Because also, Henry Hill, he obviously states that he has a great time in the mafia. Like, he misses the life. But at the end of it, he's in witness protection. Like, his wife probably hates him because she can't see her family. His kids are probably traumatized a bit. So after all that, like, life of luxury, like, you end up in witness protection and Jimmy and Paulie end up in prison. Yeah, I think Scorsese was trying to, yeah, sort of show how you know, bad the life can be. And there was another thing as well. It's one of my favourite shots in the film. It's when Henry and Karen, they're going into the Copacabana Club, and it's a tracking shot. It's one continuous shot all the way in. And I'd have thought, like, that could be, like, symbolism, I guess, for the gangsters having to do everything, like, through the back door. Like, they can't, like they can't do anything, like, legitimately, like, in the open. Like, the way that Henry and Karen go, they go through the kitchen, and like into it, and then they're seated and stuff, but they can't just walk in through the front door, presumably because of, I don't know, FBI, or they'll be spotted or whatever.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I hadn't thought of that, but now you mention it, that's a very good analogy, which at the time I didn't pick up on, because you just think, oh, they're just like VIPs and they're going through the back or whatever. But
yeah, but it's a very technical shot as well. Like, I love it. And it's introducing Karen sort of to the life, because she hasn't known. And then she asks him, she says, what do you do? He says, I think I'm in construction. And she goes, your hands, like, these hands don't look like. And he goes, oh, I work in the union or something. It's great. It's great.
So a few of the things I didn't like, and then I'll pass the mic over to you to say what you did like. So again, you know, one of my big pet peeves in film, narration, it had it, it annoyed me. I just felt like there were times, you know, show don't tell, there were times where it was Henry narrating or Karen narrating, and I was like, we don't need to be told this. Like, you can show us, you know, we don't need to be told. But that's just, you know, pet peeve of mine. I don't like narration. The action of what happened, I didn't find it all that exciting, and maybe it's unfair in a sense, because in my head I was comparing it to Casino, which obviously Scorsese directed, I believe, 5 years later in 1995, with, you know, much of the same people, starred De Niro, starred Pesci. It was about gangsters and the mafia and everything, so maybe it was unfair to compare it, but I was watching it and I was like, well, Casino was more interesting as a story and as the action. Not that Goodfellas was lacking in it, but I don't know. I feel like compared to Casino, Casino is the better film in my opinion. Or, you know, the film I enjoyed more.
Well, I disagree purely in the sense that Goodfellas just engages me much more. I'm just more engaged with Henry, with the characters. I like the performances more in Goodfellas. I mean, I think it's Scorsese's masterpiece, personally. I think it's his best film. Again, I understand that some people think, oh, like, because it's so well-liked, some people are maybe turned off because of its reputation. But I do think, I personally think it does, you know, live up to that.
And I guess to reference Casino again, I feel like, as much as I love Scorsese, I said, the only film I don't like is Taxi Driver. Everything else I've loved. I feel like, and actually it's good I mentioned Taxi Driver, outside of Taxi Driver, I feel like he's told the same story so many times. Goodfellas, Casino, The Departed, The Irishman. It's all tales of gangster, real life people, gangsters, people in the mafia or the mob, you know, Departed, obviously the Irish mob. Story of one or more people in the gang world and sort of follows them in their life and their rise and their downfall, you know. And it's just, it's I don't know, it's a bit... not stale, but because they're all great films, like they're not, it's not like to the point of where like, oh, it's this film again, because like he's even like The Irishman, I haven't seen The Irishman, but I know it's a similar sort of plot, and like I said, I love Scorsese, so I'm not like hating on him because he's one of my favorite directors, but I don't know, it's just I'm like, can we tell like a new story please, like
I don't know, for me that's Scorsese's strength. Like, I think if he wildly went off formula and tried to do like a rom-com or like a funny,
oh, yeah, no.
I feel like that wouldn't be like, that's like, he does these films best because he knows what it takes to make them. So I feel like you can't really criticize him. I know you're not, but like in general, you can't really be too harsh on him because, you know, they, for me, they are different enough from each other to not be, you know, direct copies. So I think he's just generally stays in his lane. I mean, didn't he do Shutter Island? That was different.
He's obviously done that. He's done like, you know, Taxi Driver, you know, Raging Bull, The Aviator, I think was him. What's that other one he did? King of Comedy, you know, he's done a lot of different stuff. But I just feel like he loves the tale of like the gangster, you know, and a rise and fall of a gangster.
For me, that's a strength because he loves it so much. He does it so well.
They're all, you know, Goodfellas, my rating is Goodfellas is 4 stars, Casino is 4.5, and The Departed is 5 stars. So he tells the story very well.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just, yeah, and maybe it hurt me in a sense that I'd seen Casino and The Departed before I saw Goodfellas, and I love them so much that...
Wait, so do you prefer The Departed over this?
I would say yes. I have Departed as a 5-star film.
I can't remember what... I mean, I last watched The Departed years ago, so I need to watch it again, to be honest. But I don't think I prefer it more than Goodfellas. No.
And did you have any other thoughts on Goodfellas?
I have a note here. So, you know the scene where Tommy gets shot?
Yeah, that shocked me. I didn't see that coming at all. I was like, damn.
Yeah, so that's a great scene on its own because he thinks he's going to get made.
Yeah, you know, that's what I thought. Just, boom.
You know, he walks in, he's like, oh shit, and then bang. But when Jimmy learns on the phone that he, and you know, he starts crying and breaking down.
Yeah, he turns into a Hulk. He tips the bloody phone box over.
But for me, there are two different interpretations. Like, he's crying because... So, I guess a surface level interpretation is he's crying because he's lost one of his friends in the mob. But I think you can also interpret it as he's upset that he's lost his way in to the mob. That's like the surface level, like, because clearly Tommy was his friend, but at the same time he viewed him getting made as his way more into the organization.
I think Henry says, when he's narrating that scene, this isn't the actual quote, but he says something like, you know, when one of us gets made, it's like we all get made, you know, and he makes the point that him, Henry, and Jimmy will never be made because they're Irish, right? They're half Irish. Well, Henry's half Irish, Jimmy is presumably full Irish, I don't know.
Yeah, but even though Jimmy, like, wasn't going to get made, I think because they were close friends, he still imagined he'd be, you know, more deep into the organisation. And I also liked the final scene, you know, when Henry is testifying against Jimmy and Paulie, the looks that Paulie and Jimmy give Henry, it's just like utter betrayal. They're like, oh my. But the scene before, Jimmy had basically tried to get Henry killed, but he's still betrayed. I don't know, I just find that fascinating. Like, he was looking out for himself because he knew Henry was sort of like a loose cannon. But you could tell the friendship was still there because he was like, why are you testifying against me, you know?
Yeah, I've looked a bit over the years into the Mafia because they intrigue me as an organisation. If they can be called that organisation, that makes them sound rather legitimate. A lot of the Mafia, I'd probably say more so than any other gangs, because they are a gang at their core. I mean, obviously a large, you know, multinational gang, but they're a gang nonetheless. I think something that they have that other gangs do not is the Mafia are very big on, you know, honor and loyalty. And obviously, you know, you have to swear a blood oath to get in, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think to your point, it's like, because I know from different things I've looked into the Mafia, like you can kill another person if you have permission from someone up above, right? You know, to reference the scene you mentioned, and not that I think Jimmy had permission to have Henry killed, but like, let's say hypothetically he did, like, having him killed, or even killing him himself, would be fine, but talking to the police is not. You know. So it's like betraying him in the sense of getting Henry killed, that's acceptable, but Henry betraying Jimmy and talking to the police, that is off, you know.
Do you remember what Jimmy says right at the start to a teenage Henry? He says, like, the two things you never do is you never speak and you never, like...
Never rat on your friends, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, like... I think he says you never speak and you never rat on your friends. And then at the end, that's what Henry does. So he's clearly lost the respect of Jimmy. But yeah, I just really like that sort of final scene. I was also going to mention Lorraine Bracco as Karen. I thought did really well, considering she was the only principal female cast member. I think she mentioned in an interview, like, it was pretty tough acting, you know, with all these guys doing Mafia stuff. But I think she sort of held her own really well amongst everyone. I mean, I like too many things, you know. It's just, for me, it's a, like, perfect score, perfect pacing, the performances, like, I just, yeah, Scorsese's direction, I just love it. So, yeah.
Well, let's keep the hits rolling, and we'll move on to your film, which we both loved as well.
Yes. So it's All About Eve from 1950, directed by Joseph L. Mankiewicz. It's a simple masterpiece, isn't it? It's just a masterpiece. So shall we give a quick, well, the quick synopsis, I guess, is that it's about a young lady called Eve Harrington, who kind of weasels her way into the dressing room and then the life of a very successful stage actress called Margot Channing. And yeah, it's about Margot eventually accepting her fate as like a falling actress and Eve ascending, but you can see Eve's like psychopathic tendencies, in which she plays the sweet girl getting into Margot's life and then sort of creating a plot to try and be successful. That's the sort of, I guess, synopsis.
So Anne Baxter, who played Eve, whose actual real name is Gertrude Eve, not Anne. I don't know what Anne Baxter's real name is. Maybe it's Anne Baxter. but, you know, her portrayal of Eve, like you said, like, and I said, you know, I said as much my view, she's a psychopath. Like, she's a psychopath in the truest sense of a word. She doesn't care about anybody but herself. And all she's going to do, all she wants to do, her sole quest in life is to advance herself at the expense of others. She doesn't care who she tramples to get there. She wants to get to the top.
I thought it was like a horror film in some sense.
What?
Like,
it was scary. It was. Yeah, it was.
Like, she, like this sort of unassuming girl who's sort of really, you know, quite sweet and innocent, and then just gets her way in the end at the expense of Margot, who becomes a sort of, she accepts her fate at the end.
She fools the audience as much as she fools people in the film.
Yeah, although I have to say, in that dressing room, I knew the rough synopsis, but in that dressing room scene at the start, when she sort of first goes into the dressing room to meet Margot, I don't know, like, you could tell something was a bit off. Like, she was too nice, she was too sweet.
The only time I started to suspect something was when Addison goes to visit her in the dressing room. I believe after she's acted for the first time in Margot's role, she's like in the bathroom or something, and Addison's asking all these questions and saying like, you saw Margot in San Francisco. What was the name of the theater? What's the name of your husband? And then I started to think, oh, okay, something's, you know, he knows something and something's not adding up here.
To be fair, that's probably the preferred way to view it, because I read at the back of the DVD, which says something like, when the unassuming Margot Channing gets taken, blah, blah, blah. It kind of said the synopsis, so I had suspicions, obviously. I knew her intentions. So that's probably the better way to view it, to be fair. Not knowing anything about her.
But I loved the scene of when he just, like, exoriated her. Did this, like, laundry list of, like, this is a lie, this is a lie, this is a lie.
Yeah, he just takes her apart, and you can see her break down, because that illusion that she's, like, she, at that point, she still thinks she has control over him. And then he just, like, whips out this massive list, and she's like, oh, God.
Well, it's like, she's met her match, finally.
Yeah. Because I think he says, like, I own you, like, you're mine now, because he knows the truth about her. So her, actually, thinking about it now, like, her career from then on is basically all down to him, and he can ruin her, like, at any moment, in a second. That actor, I've forgotten his name, George Sanders.
A fellow George.
Yeah, a fellow George. He was in Rebecca, do you remember the film?
He was in that as well, but
he's great. But yeah, I like that relationship. Like, you know, he brings out her true unstable self and makes her submit to him.
She was fantastic. And of course, we have to mention Betty Davis, who played Margot. Again, she should have won the Oscar.
Yeah, I know. I think actually Judy Holliday won that year for...
Who is that? Like, I don't know who that is.
Okay, I'm going to say it was for Born Yesterday, and it's a fabulous performance. It is. It's great. Because obviously, I watched Born Yesterday about a couple of months ago. And at the time, I thought, yes, that's an Oscar-winning performance. And it is. It's. I think any other year where Betty Davis wasn't in All About Eve, she would have won. But watching that now, and I didn't realise that they were the same year until like a couple of hours ago. But yeah, she should have won over Judy Holliday.
But also in 1950 was Sunset Boulevard.
Yes, I liked that as well. I think All About Eve is better. They're both about performance in both ways, like falling stars, aging stars.
Yeah, I mean, Betty Davis was just outstanding as usual. But what I liked about her performance as Margot was she was this no-nonsense character, but she also let this vulnerability shine through.
Yeah, definitely. Like, you do feel for her, even though you see it's kind of two sides of the coin, in the sense that Eve is a psychopath, of course, but Margot is also pretty crazy a lot of the time as well. Like, she gets insanely jealous, even when she doesn't really know about Eve's true intentions. She gets, you know, crazy jealous about Bill. Bill is Margot's, like, boyfriend.
Yeah, fiancé at one point. Yeah.
Fiancé, and Eve tries to sort of seal him away. So you can tell she's unhinged too, but she's definitely more, you feel more sympathy for her than Eve, obviously. But yeah, and she also gives that great speech in the car, you know, when the car's broken down, about, like, womanhood. That's a whole different theme to discuss. But she basically says that a woman, like, needs a husband. Yeah, that's a whole different topic, I guess. She's so magnetic, you just watch her all the time when she's on screen.
I think I said in my review of it, she commands the screen in every scene she's in.
She does. Even when Marilyn Monroe is on the screen.
Yes. This is one of her earliest film roles, I think. And it was obviously only a small film role. She had a few lines, but she wasn't, you know, by any means a major character.
Sorry, it's a bit of a sidetrack. I was watching it with a friend of mine, or they sort of just came in the room and said, oh, that's Marilyn Monroe. And I said, no, that's not Marilyn Monroe. That can't be. Because in my mind, I didn't know she started out in these films. So I thought she was like a massive megastar at this point. And I thought, why would she be sort of starring in like a small role in this? And then the more I looked at her, I was like, okay. And then I Googled it and it was.
I had the same thought. I was like, why would she be in this like movie? She has like a few lines, like surely she wouldn't have taken this role. And then I looked up and it's like, oh, it was like one of the first. I'm like, oh, okay, that makes sense. And apparently she was very intimidated by Betty Davis on set.
Oh, I can imagine. I can imagine. I would be if I was her. I also read she had an acting coach sometimes, like off camera, who she would like make eye contact with and try and like reassure her and things. I don't know how far she carried that through her career.
I think Marilyn Monroe and Judy Garland are probably two of the most, I don't want to say wasted talents. When I say wasted talents, I don't mean them. It's not their fault, but you look at their lives, right, and what they went through in their childhood, in the movie industry, they were both treated so awfully.
I mean, Judy Garland, I just finished my book on her, so I could go on a huge rant, but you're right.
Yeah, like they were, you know, they were wasted talents in that other people prevented them from becoming what they could be, because other people, you know, abused them and you know, treated them so awfully. And they were both great actresses. It's very unfortunate that both of them died so early. Because, you know, you think of, I always think of one of my favorite actors, which is James Dean. Well, he also died very young and he made 3 films when he died. And I always think like, man, if he had lived, like he could have been up there as like one of the best.
I know. But the thing is like Judy Garland, she was one of the best anyway. She died at what, 47? So yeah, imagine her into her 50s and 60s and 70s.
Exactly.
Would have been insane.
Right, back to the film.
Back to the film.
So talking about, you know, sort of a falling star thing, I drew comparisons, and probably could have seen any other Billy Davis film I've seen, but I drew comparisons to whatever happened to Baby Jane.
I thought that too, yeah.
Of course. Because both are, I mean, they're two totally different characters, of course, but there's similarities to be drawn, you know, like both Margot, well, Jane is obviously much more of a fallen star than Margot.
Well, Jane was a child.
Yes, exactly.
Star.
Yeah.
Margot was successful up to this. She's still successful during the film.
You know, there's obviously people in the film who can sort of see through the characters. You know, Bertie, who's Margot's assistant, you know, sees, you know, takes an instant dislike to Eve and sort of sees what she's about. You know, right away, just like Elvira in Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, you know, as much as Blanche says to Elvira, oh, like, no, Jane's fine, like, Elvira can say, like, no, she's not fine. And obviously both are about jealousy, you know, in that Eve is obviously incredibly jealous of Margot, Jane is obviously incredibly jealous of Blanche, but I think both films are 5-star films to me. They're both outstanding. But All About Eve is more relatable in a sense. Because, well, first of all, I would hope that, you know, no sibling is serving up, you know, dead rats and parrots to their disabled sister. and it's, I guess it's, I'm sure there are some siblings out there who have an awful relationship. I can't relate. I'm the only child. So I am my only sibling and I love myself. I think I'm great. but, you know, I think the story of All About Eve is more relatable in the sense of there are people who come into other people's lives, and maybe not necessarily as calculated as Eve does it, but you come into other people's lives, see what their life is, or see something in their life that they want, whether that's their money, whether that's their job, whether that's their partner, their house, whatever, their status, and they go about, you know, maybe on a benign scale, they go about emulating that. On a more severe path, they go about trying to take that away. And yeah, so I think the story was relatable in that aspect.
Relating to that point, I saw, you know, those like joke reviews on Letterboxd that we don't like. But there was one, it was something like LMAO, this happens in theater all the time or something. Or like this is what it's like to be a theater kid. So I thought, although it's a joke review, it probably does happen a lot in the film industry.
Yeah, totally.
I think I wrote a note or something? Yeah, I said, you know, I guess kind of skipping to the end, but at the end, when Addison visits Eve after she's gotten her award, and there's a young girl who's like lying there, and the cycle, like the young girl is doing the same thing. So it's like a circle of life in show business where there will always be someone younger, prettier than you coming for your top spot. And so Eve did it to Margot, and now Phoebe is doing it to Eve. And I think Addison opens the door, and he's like he knows what's up.
Like the character of Eve, like I just can't get over it. Like of how just like calculating and manipulative. Like, because you think, like, you go back to the very start, right? You think of, like, how long she's been planning it. She was outside that theater in every performance for however long, hoping someone will notice it and invite her into the dressing room. Like, she's been planning this shit for years.
All just to be a star and to have that sort of empty life and then happen again.
Exactly.
But, yeah, you can, like, one of my favorite scenes as well is in the restaurant where she is... She's apologizing in finger brackets to is it Karen?
Yes, Karen. Yeah,
to Karen, because she's sort of, yeah, she's, you know, she's all sweet, and then she suddenly switches to like a harsh tone, and she's like blackmailing her, saying, "I'll tell Eve or whoever that you did the whole prank with the petrol to get me to be an understudy," because she wants the part in the new play. So, but she just suddenly switches to that like psychopathic look. I mean, Anne Baxter, it's a great performance.
That was a great scene, which I said in my review, I've long been fascinated with psychopaths. They intrigue me so much because I'm like, how do you get that fucked up? You know, like, what, like, how does that happen? It intrigues me. Like I'm not, you know, some people are like interested in like, you know, is there like life in the universe? I'm not interested in like aliens. I'm interested in humans. You know, I'm interested in like what makes us who we are. Like, why do we behave the way we do? And that scene you just mentioned is a perfect example to me of what a psychopath is. Because this thing, they're wearing a mask. Like, this is what people don't get. They wear a mask the whole time, and they can switch at any point.
She sort of reels Karen into the conversation and gets her on her side again and saying, and you know, "Oh, I'm so sorry, you know, for what
crying,
I did." And starts crying. Yeah. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
And then when Karen's in there, she like, you know, well, what are those plants? It's like a praying mantis. So like, yes. Catches, is all like,
yeah, Venus flytrap, yeah.
Venus flytrap, that's it. There are multiple instances. You know, when she calls Karen's husband.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, tries to break their marriage.
Tries to seduce him, says she's ill or something to get him over to her flat. So yeah, it's scary. It's scary what she does.
Just utterly no morals. No morals at all. No conscience.
And that's why it's so satisfying when Addison, like, gives her the runaround, because
gives it a what for.
She's finally, you know, being told how it is. That's why it's so satisfying.
The only thing I'd call out, I think the script is probably one of the best scripts I've ever seen in a film or heard. It was just amazing.
My next point is, why can't they write great scripts like this anymore? Because it's dialogue heavy, but you have to pay attention. And I think some people now will go, "Oh, black and white films, I don't want to listen to that." But like, it's such stunning dialogue, and it like, it reels you in, and there are different layers to it.
It's just so witty. It's such a witty script. Like, there's so many back and forths and like little quips and...
Yeah, you should watch Bourne Yesterday. It's not as good as this, but I think I gave it 5 stars. I gave it 5 stars. Because the dialogue as well, it's just so witty like this. A lot of these 40s and 50s films, their scripts are just insane. They're just superbly written, yeah. Much more so than nowadays, much more so. You and Christian have joked in the past about me liking like all these 40s and 50s films. I think the reason I like them is because I prefer good dialogue and I prefer better scripts. And all the films of, well, I say all, the majority of the films I've seen from those periods are just so well written. So they draw you in more than a modern blockbuster or even a modern drama film would, for the most part.
Okay, so our final topic of the episode is some of the worst Academy Award snubs ever. Now, again, this is a completely subjective thing. It's just like, you know, when we discuss what's your best year in film. You know, it's like, I'll say this. You can look at any year the Academy Awards has been around, and they've been around for like 70, 80, I don't know how long, a long time. You can look at any year, and every year there would be people who would say, oh, well, so-and-so should have won, or this film should have won. I would say even in whatever year Parasite won, highest rated film on Letterboxd, everyone loves it. I'm sure even that year, there were people who were like, no, Parasite shouldn't have won, this other film should have won, right? So it's a completely subjective thing. You know, this is by no means the correct answer. It's just what we think.
No, we're right. We're right, Jason. We are correct.
Good, you're coming around to my way of thinking.
Yeah.
So I've got 3 different categories. I'll try and run through them fairly quickly because I'm not going to bore our listeners by talking all day. So I've got 4 films in the best actor, sorry, I should say 4 people in the best actor category, 4 people in the best actress category, and then 8 films in the best picture category. But I'm not going to talk about all of them in depth, they're just ones, and I'll tell you out of the ones which I think is the most egregious snub. We get off with best actor. So 1974, have you heard of the actor Art Carney or the film Harry in Toronto?
Only because I've read briefly about the best picture, whatever, but I haven't heard of it in detail.
Exactly. No one's fucking heard of him, and no one's heard of that movie. And that won, 1974. What should have won, do you know who should have won?
No, tell me.
Al Pacino, Godfather Part 2.
Oh, wow, okay. Yeah. I totally agree with that, yeah.
It's 4 years later, 1978. John Voight, who some might know as the father of Angelina Jolie, he won for Coming Home. He should have won was De Niro for The Deer Hunter, which I've said before on the podcast, and I'll say it 100 more times, still one of the most underrated films ever, still one of De Niro's most underrated performances. Like, to me, that's his best performance ever. The Deer Hunter is one of the best films ever, and I feel like it just never gets the respect it deserves.
Yeah. I agree.
Jumping forward 20 years, 1998, I haven't seen this film. It's been on my watch list for the longest time, and I know it's meant to be a very good film. I was just looking through the top 250 films on Letterboxd, and I'm pretty sure this film is in there. I could be wrong, but I feel like I saw it. So obviously it's rated very highly. Roberto Benigni won for Life is Beautiful. Who should have won, in my opinion, was Edward Norton for American History X. That was an outstanding performance. And you could have also given it to Tom Hanks in Saving Private Ryan.
Is that his only Oscar nomination?
No, he's got 3 Academy Award nominations. Oh, yeah, actually, yeah. So he was given Best Supporting Actor nomination for his debut in Primal Fear, which is another fantastic film. American History X, he nominated for Best Actor. And he was nominated again for Best Supporting Actor for Birdman in 2014, but he's yet to win. And then the final one I'll call out for Best Actor would be Sean Penn for Milk. He won it in 2008. I haven't seen that film since it came out. I remember enjoying it. I don't know if I have it rated on Letterboxd, but in my head it's like a 4-star film, so it's a good film. But Mickey Rourke should have won it for Wrestler.
I bought The Wrestler the other day, and I'm going to watch it. And then I can give my opinion on that. But yeah,
it is outstanding. 5-star film. Mickey Rourke is incredible. The age he was, I forget how old he was in that film. And he wasn't like, you know, 80 or anything, but he was getting up there. He's in his 60s or something. And he's doing all these wrestling stunts and Yeah, he was outstanding. But to me, the biggest snub out of those four is De Niro for The Deer Hunter. I know some people will say Al Pacino for The Godfather Part 2, but I think De Niro in The Deer Hunter is, as I said, to me, it's his best performance ever, and he should have got it.
Fair enough. Okay, yeah. All good choices. All good choices, yeah.
Best actress. So I was going to put Bette Davis in twice. I was going to put All About Eve in, and I was going to put the first film in, which we'll talk about, which is Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. I thought, no, I can't have Bette Davis twice. That's a bit, you know, unfair to other nominees. I mean, because Bette Davis was nominated so many times, you could put her in, you know, you could put her an endless amount of, you know, years, the amount she was nominated and didn't win. But the first film, yeah, 1962, she should have won for Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, as we've said before. If you want to hear more about it, go back and listen to episode 6 and hear us talk about that in more detail. The long and short of it is, she would have won, but Joan Crawford got jealous and lobbied against her, and Anne Bancroft ended up winning for The Miracle Worker. So if Joan Crawford hadn't intervened, she would have won. 3 years later, 1965, Julie Christie won for Darling. Who should have won was another Julie Andrews for The Sound of Music, which is still, to me, the best musical ever. I mean, The Wizard of Oz is a fantastic film, but if you're looking at musicals, Sound of Music, 10 out of 10, best musical ever. Jumping forward to the 80s, 1982, Meryl Streep won for Sophie's Choice. Now, I love Meryl Streep. I think she's a great actress. That year, any other film should have won it, or any other person, I should say, because Sophie's Choice was absolute shit. Her character was absolute shit.
I am curious to watch it now, Sophie's Choice. It has a good rating on Letterboxd, doesn't it?
Oh yeah, yeah, it's a good rating, yeah.
I know, obviously, yeah. That doesn't mean, but yeah, I need to watch it.
Yeah, I don't know how she won that year. And 2013, Cate Blanchett won for Blue Jasmine. Now I haven't seen Blue Jasmine. It's Woody Allen, I believe. Don't think I've ever seen a Woody Allen film. So I've heard Blue Jasmine's very good. I can't comment on how good the film was or how good Cate Blanchett was in it because I haven't seen it. But there's two people I'd call out who I gave 5 stars to the film Velvet in that year. Sandra Bullock in Gravity and Judi Dench in Philomena. I thought they were both outstanding.
Judi Dench is a national treasure for us here. You know, yeah, I love her. Yeah, she's great.
But my pick for the biggest snub in the best actress category has to be Bette Davis. Or Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, not just because of her performance, which was incredible, but just for circumstances. But she basically had it in the bag. And then Joan Crawford got jealous, and the rest is history, as they say.
Again, I agree. I haven't really disagreed with anything you said, really.
I know. So this is a great episode. We've agreed with each other the whole way through.
yeah. We've agreed everything. Yeah.
Okay, moving on to Best Picture. I'll try and run through these fairly quickly because I said there's 8 of them, and I know you want to actually talk as well, George. And I will draw breath soon and let you speak. So we'll start off very early, 1946. A film called The Best Years of Our Lives won. I haven't even heard of this film.
That's meant to be good, to be fair. That's meant to be a classic.
Yeah, I haven't heard of it, but I'm sure it must have been good if it won the Oscar. What should have won is It's a Wonderful Life. And I'll just say now, that's my pick for the biggest snub, and I'll come back to why later.
What I will say is... Is it not dangerous to say what should have won when, you know, you haven't seen the other or not? What do you think?
Yes, I agree. It is.
I know, I guess, because obviously I know it's impossible to see every single Best Picture nominee. So I get it.
I mean, some people on Letterboxd have, but I do agree with you. It is somewhat unfair to say this film shouldn't have won when you haven't seen it. I do agree. 10 years later, 1956, Around the World in 80 Days won. A few other films could have gotten it that year, I feel like. Giant, which, shamefully, I own, and it's the final film James Dean was in before he died. I haven't seen it. I need to see it. I've owned it forever. But you could have given it to a couple of other films that year as well. A couple of it Yul Brynner was in, The King and I, and The Ten Commandments. I haven't seen The Ten Commandments. I've heard it's very good. 1977, Annie Hall won, which again I think is Woody Allen. Any keen sci-fi fans out there will know that Star Wars came out in 1977. I feel like if Star Wars is an option, like, I know it's like retrospectively now we can be like, oh, Star Wars should have won, but it's like if Star Wars is the option, just give it to them. Just let them win, they win everything.
The problem is the Academy has generally not favoured sci-fi, horror, or anything like that, so... I think they were never going to give Star Wars It's hard to win. Hard to win.
I read something, and I don't know if it's going ahead because there was so much backlash to it. They were talking about creating a new category, which was something like most popular movie or like best popular movie or something, right? To accommodate all these Marvel and all these things who these people are like, well, that should have won. It's like, well, no, that's not cinema. You know?
I think it got shut down. I disagree with that as well entirely.
Because, yeah, it was just the vehicle for like the Marvel and DC films to like win.
Although, yeah, I mean, I know Black Panther got nominated for Best Picture. That's the only Marvel film that has been nominated for Best Picture, which I don't think it should have been at all.
And may it be the last.
Yeah, it'll be the last. Yeah, I agree.
1990, Dances with Wolves won. Obviously, Kevin Costner. It's like 4 hours long or whatever. I haven't seen it. I know of it. Goodfellas should have won.
Yes. Yeah.
Even though I had my little nitpicky problems with Goodfellas, it should have won. Just like you could argue Tom Hanks should have won Best Actor Oscar in 1998, so should Saving Private Ryan.
That's the biggest snub.
Yes, well, because it was Harvey Weinstein, who I'm sure everybody has heard of. Basically, it's similar. Like, what Joan Crawford did to make sure Betty Davis didn't win Best Actress, Harvey Weinstein sort of did the same thing to make sure Shakespeare in Love would win, because his company produced it and like bullied the Academy into giving him the Oscar.
Because like Shakespeare in Love, I don't know if you've seen it, but
I haven't.
But it's good. Like, it's a good, yeah, solid film. But in no world is it better than Saving Private Ryan.
2001, A Beautiful Mind won with Russell Crowe. I like that film. I gave it 4 stars. It's an enjoyable watch. However, much like I said, if Star Wars is up for nomination, you automatically give the award to Star Wars. What should have won is Lord of the Rings. Fellowship of the Ring. Like, if Lord of the Rings is there, just give him the award. Like, Lord of the Rings, to me, is the best film trilogy ever. Ever. Like, you can, people will say, oh, The Godfather. Like, no, that doesn't work, because The Godfather Part 3 is so shit. But it just lets the other two films down. Whereas every Lord of the Rings film, Fellowship of the Ring, Two Towers, Return of the King, all 10 out of 10, 5-star perfection, you can't beat them.
We can discuss this in a different podcast, I guess. I disagree with you. It's a very good trilogy. I think it's the most well-made trilogy ever in terms of production values. But I don't, for example, I like Return of the King the most. But in terms of my enjoyment, I'm not a huge fan of Lord of the Rings in general. So I don't get as much out of it as other people. I like the films, but I would only give 5 stars to probably Return of the King.
That cut me deep, just like me saying I didn't like Taxi Driver and Terminator. Cut you deep. Like, it's, I know how you feel now.
Yeah, this is my revenge. This is my revenge. But yeah, we can have a deep discussion about Lord of the Rings another time.
I need to find the time to watch it. You know, you need a whole day to watch those films. Jesus.
I know, that's true. Yeah.
So yeah, especially the one. A year after, Chicago won. Again, you could argue Lord of the Rings, Two Towers, nominated that year, should have won. I actually would have given it that year to The Pianist, with Roman, directed by Roman Polanski, starring Adrian Brody. That is an absolutely outstanding film, and I don't know how Chicago wins over like what is one of the most like moving, confronting films. Like, baffles me. Final one, 2010, The King's Speech won. I haven't seen this. It's on my Netflix watch list. I've heard it's very good. However, there's probably three other films that could have won. What should have won is Inception. Absolutely incredible. I don't know how. I mean, maybe the Academy didn't. Maybe like the voters didn't get it, which is understandable. It's a hard film to get, but it's, you know.
I disagree with you again. I like Inception, but I don't think it should have won Best Picture. No, not at all.
So the two films I call out. I mean, I would have given to Inception, but I think you also could have given to The Fighter, which was a fantastic film. Or, and I actually rewatched this a few nights ago, and I actually upped its rating from 4 stars to 4.5 stars, and that is the 2010 remake of True Grit.
Yeah, I would argue True Grit should have won over The King's Speech, definitely. And Inception.
How?
Because I just think True Grit's a better film than Inception. I don't know, I find some Nolan films pretty, I don't know, I'm not as much of a fanboy of a Nolan as some other people are. I find his films quite pretentious.
Yeah, fair point. I mean, they are very confusing, especially Tenet.
Inception is a million times better than Tenet. So, you know, you have that.
Yeah, that's a small victory for me.
So
you had your hastily assembled list.
I kind of forgot that we were discussing this, so sorry, audience. My list isn't as extensive, but I've got some. So the first one is Glenn Close should have won Best Actress for Fatal Attraction in 1987. Cher won for Moonstruck. So I think Glenn Close is brilliant in Fatal Attraction. I don't know if you've seen it.
I haven't. I know of it. Is that the one? I always get Fatal Attraction and Basic Instinct confused, even though I've seen neither. Is Fatal Attraction the one with a rabbit?
Yes, the famous bunny boiler scene.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah, so that's that one. Next one I've got is Alfred Hitchcock was snubbed a lot of times. You know, I'm a fan of him. He should have won Best Director for Vertigo. James Stewart should have won for Best Actor for Vertigo as well, I think. Anthony Perkins for Psycho wasn't even nominated for an Oscar, which I think he should have been. Charlie Chaplin, I love Charlie Chaplin. He didn't win any Best Actor Oscars. He was nominated for The Great Dictator, I think for City Lights as well. But I don't think he won for Best Director either. So I just don't understand that. He should have won at least one Oscar. For me, he has some of the best acted and best directed films of the 30s and 40s. So he should have won at least one. Maybe there was sort of prejudice against silent films when he was still making them in the 30s. So maybe it was that. I don't know. Marlon Brando for A Streetcar Named Desire. Bogart won for The African Queen, which I like that film.
I feel like it's hard when you've got two like all-time greats going up against each other.
I know. I think Humphrey Bogart, they wanted to reward him. You know, I think he'd lost a previous year or something.
I've actually read a lot when I was looking up this sort of stuff. A lot of people get, if they have a really good performance the next year, they'll get it that year as like a makeup to be like, oh, sorry we didn't give it to you for that performance. We'll give it to you for this one.
Yeah, but also he's good in The African Queen. He's with
Catherine Hepburn, isn't he? Yeah.
Catherine Hepburn, who's there insane together. But Marlon Brando put in a better performance in A Streetcar Named Desire. One more. So Joan Fontaine for Rebecca. She won it. She won a year later for Suspicion, which is another Hitchcock film, which is a worse film than Rebecca, and a worse performance. I don't quite understand that. And I think Ginger Rogers won instead for Kitty Foyle. I don't know what that is. So for me, I haven't seen it, but that's a crime because Joan Fontaine is great in Rebecca. Oh, okay, one more. Rami Malek for Bohemian Rhapsody is very overrated.
Yeah, I'm curious to know who else was nominated because I saw Bohemian Rhapsody. I liked it. I think I gave it 4 stars, maybe 4.5. I think I gave it 4. So it was a good film, but I don't think he should, you know, depending on who else was nominated, I don't think he should have won the Oscar.
So there was Christian Bale for Vice, Bradley Cooper, A Star Is Born, Willem Dafoe, At Eternity's Gate.
I hated that film.
And Viggo Mortensen for Green Book. I mean, it wasn't a hugely strong year anyway, I think, but I still think, maybe looking at that, he was sort of the best of the bunch.
I mean, yeah, I've heard Christian Bale is very good in Vice. I mean, it's Christian Bale, of course. Bradley Cooper in A Star Is Born, not particularly Oscar worthy. Whatever the other one was, At Eternity's Gate, I love Van Gogh. I'm like the biggest, I love Van Gogh so much, and I dislike that film. And whatever the other one was, Green Book. Again, I've heard it's very good, but I've not seen it.
I just think Rami Malek was a little bit, he was good, but I think quite a little bit overrated in his performance. So yeah, that's my quite unorganized list compared to yours.
When you look at it, said over all the years the Academy has been around, it is baffling how some actors, actresses, directors, pitchers didn't win. Like, you look at it, you're like, how did that happen?
I know. Also, I think sometimes the Academy favor films if they're like about Hollywood or anything about America, the film industry, they love. So they'll tend to award films based on that too.
That's why Parasite, not that I've seen it, but that's why that was such a big deal when it swept the whole thing, was because, like, you know, a foreign film hadn't really done that before.
No, I don't think had a foreign film won Best Picture? I don't think.
I want to say no. I could be wrong, but I want to say no, because I feel like that's why it was such a big deal, because it was like the first one to do it.
Yes, yeah, it was. Yeah, the first foreign language film to win Best Picture. So,
just crazy. You think of like how long the Academy Awards have been around, and how much great stuff has come from not America or not English speaking countries. And it's taken to what, 2019 to win? Like,
we could do a whole podcast on the Oscars because there's a lot of stuff to talk about there. You know, there's tons.
Well, I think that wraps up episode 8. Thanks everyone for listening as usual.
Yeah, thank you guys. Thank you a lot.
We'll see you in a week.
See ya.